sets and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true. Will always love you, no matter what you do. Rise is the light, the light, the light.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
Welcome. Welcome to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. Today we remember the life of Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride was a 19-year-old African-American woman who was shot in the head by Theodore Wafer, a white man, in Dearborn Heights outside Detroit, Michigan. Since the November 2nd horrific tragedy, Dearborn police failed to charge Mr. Wafer. But after community pressure and national outrage mounted, Mr. Wafer turned himself in. We play sound from a documentary made by local activist Dream Hampton, a filmmaker and writer based in Detroit.
We will also be airing clips tonight from a mind-blowing conversation between renowned writer, scholar, black feminist Bell Hooks and MSNBC's Melissa Harris-Perry, which took place at the New School in early November, my old school. That's a shout out there.
Woo woo.
Their dialogue focused on the black female voice, representation and subjectivity within, yes, imperialist white supremacy, capitalist patriarchy.
Finally, tonight, we'll be looking more closely at the newly tabled Bill 60, known more popularly as the Quebec Charter of Values. We're honored to welcome Sarah Malik in studio to talk more about the implications of this bill. All that and more coming up on another edition of Spitfire, CKUT 90.3 FM.
This is for the
You're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month on the one and only CKUT 90.3 FM. It's just around 6:05 right now. We're going to go straight into remembering Renisha McBride. Outrage continues in the aftermath of the killing of the 19-year-old black woman from Detroit, Michigan. In the early hours of November 2nd, McBride was shot dead on the front porch of a Ted Wafer's home, where she reportedly had gone to seek help after a car crash. Ted Wafer's name was not initially reported in media outlets, but The Voice of Detroit, a local newspaper, confirmed his name a few days before he turned himself in. On November 12th, Detroit media aired audio of Dearborn Heights police dispatcher who sent police to investigate the shooting after the homeowner being Wafer, called 911 to say he had shot an African-American woman he did not know on his porch. On Friday, November 15th, Theodore Paul Wafer, a 54-year-old white man, turned himself in and was charged with second-degree murder, manslaughter, and a related gun charge. It's important to note that the police did not formally arrest and charge Wafer from the outset. He himself turned himself in. Today we play sound from a rally in Detroit of Detroit residents calling for the arrest of the shooter and for the federal government to investigate possible civil rights charges. The footage was collected and assembled by Detroit-based filmmaker and activist Dream Hampton. We will also hear from Dream Hampton talking with Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman about what she describes as the criminalization of black corpses.
Mm-hmm.
19-year-old Renisha McBride is dead. Police telling us she took her last breath on this porch on Outer Drive in Dearborn Heights.
Southeastern Michigan is one of the most segregated areas in the country. That's a fact. It has been a fact for decades. It's a kind of apartheid where the city of Detroit is 80% plus black and is surrounded by very segregated suburbs. Dearborn Heights is what we call a sunset town, and it's basically, you know, towns that historically black people shouldn't be caught in after dark. It's something that was very common in the 50s, and it continues to today.
Would you walk around that neighborhood at night?
I should be able to. They're telling the media that this was an accident. If this was an accident, the last time I checked, that's manslaughter, you know? But I personally am outraged that a 19-year-old girl was shot in the face less than 36 hours ago and no one's in custody. I find that outrageous.
Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride.
It doesn't make any sense why he isn't here right now, locked up in the cell, on some sort of charge of murder, manslaughter, whatever. It is not just. Why is he still at home?
Renisha could have easily been me. She had a life that was worth us gathering here today.
Every life in our community is valuable, whether you're in Detroit, whether you're in Dearborn, whether you're in Inkster, in particular as far as black life. You know, the fact of the matter is, here's a person who was in an accident, and she's trying to seek help. Gets a bullet in her head.
I'm sick and tired of seeing black women murdered, raped, beaten, shot, and nobody's talking about it. I'm sick of the apathy. I'm sick of the apathy in the community. I'm sick of the apathy in the media. And it's enough is enough. Where is this man? Who is he connected to? That's and right. Why don't we know who he is?
That's right.
Why is he not in there?
That's
if
right.
If my child, 19, if my son was 19 and shot somebody, he would be under that jail. This is wrong. This is wrong. And everybody needs to be out here complaining about it. This young woman is dead.
This is always wrong.
This is nothing new. This is nothing new. Dearborn is a city of restrictive covenants, right? This is a place that said, we prefer our own kind to live here, right? They've had to take that to the Supreme Court. This is fertile ground for the new apartheid.
Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy, she needs to step in and call this man. And perhaps U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid at the federal level may need to investigate her civil rights being violated according to federal law. We need some justice here. No justice?
No peace!
No justice?
No peace!
No justice?
No peace!
Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride. Renisha McBride.
I find it problematic that the media continues to refer to Ted Wafer as a 54-year-old homeowner. The Voice of Detroit, a local paper, named him 4 or 5 days ago. I think that he does not deserve anonymity. He's neither a minor or a rape victim. This kind of is a collusion in my mind. I've not seen media protect a shooter in this way, even if it were an accidental shooting. When accidents are reported, often names are divulged. So I find that incredibly problematic from the outset, and it just indicates the opaque way that the Dearborn Heights Police Department has dealt with the public from the outset of this tragic killing.
And what is the explanation for this man not being arrested?
His whiteness is the only explanation I can come up with. You know, her black body justification, de facto. A toxicology report Our Renisha McBride's body is more criminalization of black corpses. This criminalization of black corpses is deeply troubling as well. We saw this happen with Trayvon. We saw his public record, his school record, his attendance record, whether or not he'd ever smoked pot. You know, this teenager, like, kind of criminalized even as he was a corpse. I'm not interested in seeing that happen again with Renisha McBride. Like the family, I'm hopeful that Prosecutor Kim Worthy, who will do the right thing and bring justice for the McBride family.
That was sound from a rally among Detroit area residents calling for justice for Renisha McBride, an innocent 13-year-old black woman who was shot fatally in the face by Dearborn Heights resident Ted Wafer when she knocked on his door asking for assistance after getting into a car accident. That was John Coltrane, the drum thing in the background. We will be right back.
Listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio 90.3 FM. The time is 6:14. We're turning now. Thank you so much, Alyssa, for preparing that report. It's really important that we meditate on the story, more. So we're turning now to a powerful and inspiring conversation which took place between MSNBC's Melissa Harris-Perry and renowned black feminist scholar and writer Bell Hooks. And that was earlier this month at the New School in New York City during their Black Female Voices, Who is Listening? A public dialogue that's part of Bell Hooks's week-long residency. So we're going to go to clips of that right now.
I'm not used to being with a celebrity.
Oh. Yeah, I'm pretty sure in this crowd you're the celebrity. So we were trying to figure out how to get started, and I wanted to start by just picking up on that last insight about the fact that none of us come to black feminism except through you.
I am 20 years older than this baby up here. And one of the things that I thought about is my early work focused so much on the question of finding our voice. And I was thinking about how Melissa represents a generational shift, because she has this whole national voice. And so part of what we want to talk about is, has there been a meaningful, concrete change in how we hear, think, and feel about the black woman's voice?
So I'm not sure how I ended up with a television show. And I don't mean that to be joking. I really am not quite sure how that happened. Clearly, it's about a set of very odd occurrences that were part of this moment historically, where you end up with an African-American man as president, and you end up with the most popular commentator on this African-American male president being a queer woman who is out and butch when they don't overly make her up, and there's sort of a shift that occurs around representation, and that shift that occurs around representation occurs at the same time that there's a profit motivation to get an audience, right? So I don't want to miss that. There's no moment in cable news where people are making any kind of decision that isn't based on a belief that there is audience and income and something else out there. So I assume you talk about being 20 years younger, so I come of age in exactly the right, I mean, in fact, I pretty regularly say, like, the smartest thing you could have ever done was to have been born in the 70s. If you were going to be born a black girl, like, to be born in the 70s meant being born right at the end of that civil rights struggle, but before the backlash got really ugly, in the one moment when there were integrated public schools in the South, just for that 1 second before white flight took all the resources out of the public schools in the South, right at that moment, so that when I graduate from college, we're in an economic upswing and there are jobs. When I finish the PhD, people are getting multiple academic jobs, not like searching for an adjunct position. Like, there's just structurally a set of realities.
Yeah.
But I don't think any of those structural realities that let a little moment like me come through represents an American shift in who we want to hear from.
All right. Whereas I feel, you know, enormously blessed. I always get annoyed with my sister when she says she's blessed and highly favored. But, but I do want to say I think of myself just as, you know, Melissa has a mainstream image voice that I came up really out of nowhere. You know, little bell hooks writing, Ain't I a Woman, Black Woman, and Feminism. And that sometimes I do feel like, wow, you know, there is this audience that reads bell hooks and that tells me how my work has affected their life. And I think as a black woman writer, that is so amazing. I mean, when I think about Audre Lorde, when I think about Pat Parker, when I think about Zora Neale Hurston, and I think about all the black women writers, I mean, my students already don't know who Audre Lorde is. They never knew who Pat was, you know? And I think that to be a black woman writer of nonfiction and to be read is to be blessed and highly favored. And so I think that just as there is space now for your voice, because it's a product, it sells, it creates people like us running to hear her and watch her, there's also that other climate of people searching for truly dissonant ways of thinking and being and trying to carve out different ways to live our lives. And I think that's especially a tension for black women, because we haven't, as a group, really carved out different ways to live our lives. When I first, you know, published at Ain't I a Woman, the white women at South End Press said, you know, it was such an angry book, and I didn't know what they were talking about. Because, again, I felt it was a clear book. It was a book saying things that hadn't been said before. But anger, you know, I'm one of these black women. If I'm angry, you're going to know that I'm angry, and I'm gonna own my anger. And so I knew that that wasn't the case, and that has been something that I feel is a constant battle. I've been referring a lot to Sweet Honey in the Rock, when we work for freedom, we cannot rest, because people are constantly using anger and difficult. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to admit, I get difficult now more than anger.
Yeah.
You know, Belle is difficult.
Yeah.
You know, when people drop you or when from publishing or something, and they say, well, Belle is difficult.
Yep.
And it's because you raise certain kinds of images. And once again, I think it's about, Melissa, that interface between our radical political integrity and the fact that we are in imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. So,
and you might be, so I was angry at Ms. Metha. Her inability to see that it was patently
mess up all my theories.
Right? No. But like, but not just her. I was angry with the idea that we continue to propagate this notion that to be poor is somehow relaxing. That people are chilling on public service. And that riskiness is associated with wealth, right? So the only thing I push back against is the notion that I'm irrationally. I'm mad, but I'm mad about something. I'm not mad as an inherent aspect of my blackness or my womanhood, right? But mad about something. And you know, I get difficult, but I am difficult. Like, but so too. I mean, like, so are all the white guys, right? And I'm legitimately not trying to be funny in the sense that I come to work after my producers come to work, and I'm a little bit, you know, demanding, and, you know, a lot of times, like, so I difficult. But all the white boys who are difficult too, in everything from the academy to general life to, you know, new, like, right? And but it's as though that difficulty is presumed to be legitimate, whereas ours is illegitimate.
Whereas, you know, it's funny. I don't think that I'm difficult. I think I'm exacting and precise. And I mean, I think the words that we use are very important, because I think that for me, a lot, I mean, let's face it, folks, you don't be a black woman from a working class background in America and write more than 30 books because you're sitting around being difficult.
Right.
You know, that work comes out of the amazing discipline of my life, which I don't necessarily attribute to my ego or me, but to the recognition of what it takes to get a particular job done. And that will, as many of you have experienced in this room, to write, to put other things aside, to write, to sit at my computer and key in the Beasts of the Southern Wild piece while I am sitting there crying because I just can't take another image of an abused black child being represented as entertaining. And I am sitting there and I'm writing, but I'm also hurting. I'm hurting because we can't get past the construction of black children as little mini adults whose innocence we don't have to protect. You know, who we can consider cute if they're being slapped around by an alcoholic father. You know, not to mention all the... I'm going to say that what I'm tired of in general is sentimentality. I mean, James Baldwin said, sentimentality is the ostentatious parading of excessive and spurious emotion. It is the mark of dishonesty, the inability to feel. So I'm actually, we can go away from particular movies. I'm concerned about why is it that there's a kind of collective response to the plantation culture we as black people are living in that has primarily to do with sentimentality. With people, whether we're talking about the butler, whether we're talking about some of Tyler Perry's stuff, it's like, you know, I mean, let's stand and weep, and let's weep and weep, you know, and while we're weeping, the violence against us globally, the global slavery continues. And I'm trying to analyze, and maybe you have some thoughts about it, but why is there this obsession at this historical moment with sentimentality and melodrama? Because, you know, my favorite melodrama is Imitation of Life. I'm old enough to have left. Mama, I did love you. I did love you. But again, Mama don't get to hear that because she did. And so, what are your thoughts about that? This sort of upsurge, I feel, in sentimental portraits of blackness. Not, and we don't just have to talk about slavery because the butler certainly, you know.
Yes. Okay, so there's Django on the one hand, then there's the butler, and God help me, the help. I guess
all of which are sentimental.
Yes, right. I'm just kind of running in my head what you're saying and trying to think through this a little bit. It certainly felt to me like the help and the butler are popular culture responding to the angst of the possibility not only of black empowerment in the personhood of President Obama, but also the desire for the magical Negro to reappear to make things better. So that the economic downturn itself, right, and the sense of white America experiencing for the first time in 50 years the unemployment rates that black folks have been living with for 60 years, right? So that the Tea Party can actively just weeks after President Obama's inauguration, can sort of take to the mall in anger about a 10% unemployment rate. And we know, like, 10% unemployment rate for black people would be cause for, like, Juneteenth, right? We would be happy. And I presume that part of what happens then, why we need the butler, why we need the help, and so maybe, and I'm going to pause and think about, maybe this is also why we need to bring back slavery, but I'm not sure, but I'll think about it. But maybe the reason we need to go engage with them in our fictional, emotional lives is because those Negroes they solved the problems of America through their willingness to sacrifice for the American project. And so, I mean, the fact that, I will say, so at the end of 12 Years a Slave, what happens? He goes to the American court system, right? There is no Django fan, like the fantasy is that, right? What the actual enslaved man does is he goes and takes these men to court. There is a presumption, even in that moment, that somehow there will be justice available. The thing that we actually did in the years following emancipation was to run for office and buy land. And I mean, it's so maybe there's a desire to reconstruct that version of black folks so that we could fix what is currently wrong, because that's always been our magical capacity.
Or so that we can simply grieve. Hmm. We can have a vehicle for the expression of the depth of our grief. Because I do believe that for some time now, black people collectively have been caught in a profound grief. I've been working on writing about justice and using Martin Luther King's Where Do We Go From Here? And I'm just amazed that Dr. King was talking about fascism. He was talking about he was so prescient that there will be things like the Tea Party. And the thing that he says that's so amazing is that there will be this growth of a native form, these are his words, of fascism as black people press forward for equality. And then he says that awesome insight that white people would rather destroy democracy than have racial equality. And I think we know that that's not true of all white people, but we really see that. And those of us who live in very depressed white areas like Appalachia, I mean, we see it so clearly that people would rather have white supremacy and hierarchy than any kind of justice. That people really think justice, you know, those Negroes have had enough. We've given them enough. And so I think that's what troubles me, Melissa, about the sentimentality, because I feel it shifts us away from the forms of analysis. Like, I mean, I am myself, I've been a reader of King, but I had been away from Where Do We Go From Here? And so when I read it again and I thought, boy, King was talking about fascism, about what we had to do, and so much of what he puts out, we haven't done. The critical consciousness. It just kind of, in a way, saddened me so deeply, because I think that we do live in this space, black people, brown people, of cognitive dissonance, that we know white supremacy is real, but at the same time, we would like to walk through our daily lives as though justice is real, democracy is real, equality is real. I mean, if anything that I could say about 12 Years of Slavery is that it depicted that we see them walking through their lives thinking they've made it, that they can live as assimilated black people in this bourgeois white world. And there is something so almost unbelievable about his level of innocence about the horrific nature of white supremacy, because he really believes that there is a whiteness that will protect him. Like, you know, and that to me is like, wow, if someone can come from that time period and believe that whiteness will protect them, then I think about our son, our brother, Trayvon Martin. What did he think would protect him? Did he think that he was in danger of losing his life? Or did he have that innocence again about whiteness? that many of us carry, and many of our young people carry it especially. I mean, both here at the New School, everywhere I go, it is young people especially who will argue that race has ended, that we're in the post-racial. Go ahead, jump in.
So,
welcome back to Spitfire. Well, you were on Spitfire listening to Bell Hooks and Melissa Harris Perry speak earlier this month at the New School. I was part of a lecture series that was ending Bell Hooks's residency there. So that was really powerful, intense.
For sure.
Spanned a lot of different topics, sort of core focus on the Black female voice right now in this moment, media representation, subjectivity. Mm-hmm. What do you guys?
Grief.
Yeah, for sure. I thought it was interesting, this whole point about sort of the Black female voice and just voices of women of color in particular. And I guess they kept coming back to sort of, so much has changed, so much the same, right? What has really changed, and has anything really changed at all? I wanted to kind of throw that thought out there to you guys and see what you think about that in terms of, you know, our tagline when we open the show, we come together to say no to the silencing of our voices. And there was actually a question. They had a Q&A period after this lecture, and someone had asked a question about the impulse to self-silence as well. And sort of asking, you know, Bell Hooks and Melissa Harris Perry how they navigated that. That's something that I've definitely felt within myself. So, yeah, I wonder what you guys think about that.
Well, I want to go back to something that Melissa Harris Perry said at the beginning of the talk, which is that, and which I really agreed with, which is that no one comes to Black feminism except through Bell Hooks. I really relate to that. And she was talking in the clip that we listened to about Ain't I a Woman, Black Woman and Feminism, which I believe she wrote when she was like 20. She's just so prolific. And she's right. Like, it was not an angry book. It was just talking about racism and the suffrage movement, which is like at this point, like, so basic. But at that point in the early 80s, no one had thought about it, had said that much about it. I'm really struggling with this actually right now. What I love about moments like watching someone so prolific like Bell Hooks and watching someone who also is really awesome and who I really like, Melissa Harris Perry, in the same room together. It's so sustaining. It so makes you feel like, okay, so the bad week I've had where I've listened to, you know, my classmates basically apologize for rape, where I've, you know, seen and heard and had horrible, like, racist and sexist things done to me through microaggressions. You watch something like that and it makes you feel like, it reminds you that you're not crazy, or if you are crazy, you're driven crazy because of forces around you. There's not something inherent about your craziness, or it's not innate to your psychosis. So that it's just there's just so much to say. I don't, in terms of the what you were saying, Malek, things changing, things staying the same. I think it's just more of a constant struggle. It's not about how much time has gone by. It's just some days you feel I'm going to continue on. I'm going to keep saying no to the silencing of my voices. And then some days you're like, I'm exhausted. I want ice cream. Right. And I'm going to watch episodes of like a horrible show that I know is really immoral.
Right. What do you think, B?
Well, I just want to say that I really, in response to Spitfire, Women of Color, We Say No to the Silencing of Our Voices, that this show is really important to me just for the very reason of cultivating my voice in a world where I think that's not encouraged. And yes, when I saw this float by on Facebook, posted by two brown girls, amazing podcast, everyone should go check it out. Two brown girls, probably reblogged from various other awesome sites out there. But when I saw it, like, I literally like curled up Friday night and just like, and then I made my boyfriend watch it, and we were just like so like inspired and felt like there was hope and there is this structural analysis for dealing with what appears to be like a meltdown, you know, especially in the wake of the injustice of Renisha McBride and what happened earlier this month and what happened last year with Trayvon Martin. And just like, you know, it's, without these voices, without these elders, I think I would not, like, so I just search for them at all times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really respected what Bell Hooks said, which is essentially about the will that it takes to sort of sit down and write, and even when it's painful. And she talks about, Beasts of the Southern Wild. And in another place in the lecture, she talks about her critique of Lean In and how difficult that was for her to write. And I honestly take a lot of inspiration from it, because I know for myself, you know, I'm a poet, I do spoken word. But I've gotten so many messages that, what I have to say isn't important. I'm not talented enough to say it. I need to let somebody else represent me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That it's hard not to internalize those things. And I think I'm coming to a place now where I'm just remembering, like, no, like, my voice is vital, and urgently important, and that I have to give it that value as well. And get that will to write.
Thank you so much for that question, Malak.
I want to meditate on, what do I want to meditate on? I'm meditating on so many things at once. I can't focus on one thing to meditate on.
For sure.
I wanted to bring it back maybe to the question of sentimentality. And also the way Bell Hooks talked about that in the context of Black people dealing with grief, you know, not just economic misery and protracted, you know, police violence and all of the structural manifestations of things that would obviously make people really, really sad, but just a profound kind of lack of healing that passes down through generations, and how it's weird that it gets kind of, grief is supposed to be sold and sewed up through these movies about slavery The Butler,
right?
These like kind of racially transcending movies where it's like this, but like I didn't see The Butler, but I mean, I swear all
it
I needed to see was the trailer.
It was, and
I
was very just, sentimental.
I saw it. It was hella sentimental. I mean, Oprah's in it. What do you expect?
But it was interesting to me because didn't you guys like, well, okay. 'Cause to me, I love Django. And I was kind of sad that MHP didn't like Django. But I was also surprised that she didn't like Django so much. But then she liked 12 Years a Slave so much. Like, she talked about it on her show for, like, 3 segments. And I was like, okay, wow. It can't be that good. It's just, like, how brutal. They just kept saying, like, this is the first movie where you see how brutal slavery is.
Because we didn't
brutal
know that.
Slavery
we
is.
Had, yeah,
and
we
Bell
had
Hooks
no
was
idea.
Kind of like, okay, but it's still not real. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Just because Django was obviously not representing itself as mimicking that era.
Right.
I mean, they're playing Rick Ross in the background. Like, it's right. Not a historic piece.
Yeah.
It's just playing in fantasy, but so is 12 Years a Slave. So I thought that was an interesting... this isn't a question. This is
no,
just
well,
commentary.
I totally would like to respond to that. Like, it's, you know, in talking about the voice and what's allowed and what's not allowed, it seems that, you know, exacting precise critical analysis of, you know, imperialist, white supremacist, patriarchal capitalism is not allowed. Sentimental voices
right.
about the past are
yes,
allowed.
Yes,
but,
absolutely.
You know, revenge films that, you
absolutely.
Know, are not allowed. So,
absolutely.
You know, Bell Hooks is known for being actually criticized by her contemporary feminists and other people for being kind of been like angry and like saying sort of like, I'd like to kill this person for being
yes.
a racist. And,
yeah.
you know, so it's yeah. like, it's like Melissa Harris Perry is not allowing herself to mm-hmm. go there because she has an audience and she has this product and
job, you know, she
yeah,
talks in the
I don't think,
about
I don't
the
think
white men who let her have her job.
Yeah. I like that, though. She really, like, I mean, there's no way you could have, like, watched that show and not seen that she, like, really basically said, like, I work for white people, like, plantation owners.
Yes.
She kind of said that, and she still has her show.
Yeah.
So, sorry to cut you off.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, so I think it's, like, well, I don't know. I totally forget what I was saying at this point. But.
No, wait. No, it's good, though, because it's, like, in lieu of actual healing and grief, and where
yeah.
we have sentimentality. That's what we have.
Right. And I think it's really dangerous because, you know, Bell Hooks was saying that it doesn't allow for the formal analysis and then
yeah.
the organizing
yeah.
that
yeah.
we actually
yeah.
should be spending
yeah.
our time
yeah.
doing, while at the same time she's like mm-hmm. acknowledging that there's a deep, you know, there's like so much healing to be done and
mm-hmm.
and you know, how do you even process
yeah.
all of that when it's still going on? And just to extend, like she was saying, like global slavery right now yeah. for, you know, black people, but it's like right. all people of color, I think, around the world.
Slaves. More than there were right at now. The height of slavery.
Yeah, but when she talks about the plantation culture, she's not talking about the slave trade today. She's also right. just talking about the legacy of the plantation right. culture. And I think in the Q&A, there was one person who was talking about poverty. He was trying to make a point about the class differences among black folks, and that there are really successful black folks who mm-hmm. are making good money, but then there's the majority of people in places like New York and urban mm-hmm. areas around mm-hmm. the U.S. Mm-hmm. and in Canada, where disproportionately black and Latino people are really, really poor and in concentrated poverty. And Bell Hooks shot back like, well, that doesn't mean, just because people who are black are now making money doesn't mean that they're right. not, you know, in living in the plantation culture. Right. I mean, the plantation
people
culture
were doing
is,
well on the plantation
is a state of mind.
Yeah.
And it's like yeah. it goes back to the way she was talking about the main character in 12 Years as a Slave. He's so naive about his inability or his inability to access whiteness in mm-hmm. the white culture.
Mm-hmm.
And he's constantly put back in this plantation mentality, but he doesn't see it. And like so many, how it's so easy for rich black folks to feel like, well, we've overcome it right. or like the way in which that we experience this is so different. And it's not to say that poor people and rich people are both treated negatively in the same way. Obviously there are real differences, but just right. this, you can't escape the, like, I think what she's trying right. to say is we're all in the plantation culture.
I love, that's why she says, she calls it imperialist white supremacy, capitalist patriarchy. You know, she's really one of the founders, I think, of intersectionality in that way, because yes, it's about race, but it's also about class and supremacy. She's great.
Thank you so much for participating.
Thank you, Victoria, for encouraging us to meditate on bell hooks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yay. So yeah, just on the theme of voice and cultivating one's voice and looking for those good voices, we're gonna go to a poem by Jean Cortez called Find Your Own Voice, or Find Your Voice, actually. I don't know.
Use your voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Thank you so
much. But it's all good, though.
Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it.
Find
your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it.
Find
your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it.
Find
your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. The sounds of gristle on dry leaves are not like sounds of insults between pedestrians. Those women laughing in the window do not sound like air conditioners on the blink. The river turtle does not breathe like a slithering borgastrictor. The roar of a bull is not like the cackle of a hyena. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it.
Find
your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. The growl of a sea leopard is not like the teething cry of a baby. The slash of a barracuda is not like the gulp of a leaping whale. The speech of a tiger shark is not like the bark of an eagle fish. The scent of a gardenia is not like the scent of a tangerine. Find your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it.
Find
your own voice and use it. Use your own voice and find it. Find it. Find it. Find it. Find it. Find it.
You're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is 6:46. We've been covering a discussion with Bell Hooks and Melissa Harris Perry that took place earlier this month at the New School in New York City. It was a really, really, really wonderful event. We encourage all of you to YouTube it, to look on Facebook. We know it's there. Bell Hooks is the author of over 30 books, including Ain't I a Woman, Feminism is for Everybody, We Real Cool. She writes about race, class, gender, culture. She writes children's books. She's a cultural commentator on plays and film. My personal favorite is her critique of Madonna in the early 90s.
Yes. She had a mouthful to say about Miss Madonna.
I think she probably still would have a mouthful to say. Yes. And we just wanted to pay homage to her. As well, Melissa Harris Perry, she's a professor of political science and African American studies at Tulane University. She's the author of Sister Citizen, which is a book about American political shaming of Black women and denying Black women full citizenship. It's an interesting read. You should check it out. We were kind of exploring the tensions maybe between what Melissa Harris Perry was saying as somebody who is keen on keeping her job for a corporate television network while still, you know, articulating Black feminist perspectives and goals. And Bell Hooks was very celebratory of Melissa Harris Perry, but at the same time, you know, pushed her on a couple of things, which I thought was really good. As someone who watches Melissa Harris Perry, she's on Saturdays and Sundays, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. on MSNBC. There's often positions she takes that you're kind of like, how do you square that with your Black feminism? We're not really sure. So it was nice to see those two women together. There was a question in the Q&A about Black American imperialism in the era of Obama. That was kind of interesting for Canadian listeners, sort of how the African American experience in the body of the Black president is being used to, you know, wage wars and continue dominating from a U.S. hegemonic perspective. And what does that mean? And how Black people in the United States who are supportive of the president are kind of culpable in that? That was kind of an interesting question, although it was a bit of, they kind of both dodged it, to be honest. But you should check it out. We are going to go now to an interview that Malek is going to do. Malek?
Yeah, we're turning now to an interview on the Quebec Charter of Values, the P60 bill recently tabled by the PQ government. I have on the line Sarah Malek, with whom I had the pleasure to host last Wednesday a teach-in on the charter. Sarah works as an equity educational advisor at McGill, but tonight she's representing her own views, not those of the university. Sarah, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, Malek. Thanks so much for having me.
So I would jump right in. I'm wondering, why did you feel that it was important to sort of organize and speak out against this bill?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I guess I think it's important to organize and speak out against oppression, period. And I think that, you know, the freedoms that we have or the ability we have to live our lives sometimes in ways that let us thrive and sometimes in ways that don't are quite vulnerable and can be really precarious in society. That vulnerability, that precarity is something that some of us feel more than others.
Right,
like,
right.
More acutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we have to... just sort of as a baseline, we have to be really kind of vigilant, and we have to be doing the work to preserve that, ability to live freely. But right now, what we're seeing with Bill 60, with the Charter of Values, is kind of like a direct, sort of accelerated and really opportunistic attack on, specifically on, like, racialized and marginalized religious communities. So for that reason, it felt really important to sort of push back and not let what's happening right now happen.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of what's happening right now, what is it that you find to be sort of the most troubling about Bill 60?
Oh, there's so much that is very troubling. I suppose one of the first things that I would say is the massive empowerment that the bill gives to decision makers sort of across the board. There are sections of the charter that would give huge powers to the minister responsible for the charter in terms of, like, really one-sidedly deciding what is and is not acceptable in the public sphere or in the public service. And the way that the public sphere is defined is sort of, like, really broad and left quite ambiguous. So there's, like, a lot of room for arbitrary decision-making and just sort of the extent to which government control is going to, like, encroach into people's lives and affect their ability to, like, raise their children the way that they want to and, you know, have family gatherings on religious occasions and those sorts of things. Like, just the extent of the impact is really, really threatening and really worrying.
Absolutely. Speaking of the extent of that impact, I'm wondering how you, because I know you do identify as a Muslim woman, Sara. So I'm wondering, how do you sort of, as a Muslim woman, as a woman of color who's targeted by this bill, how do you navigate that? How do you survive in a society where you're so overtly targeted by the state?
I'm not always sure if I do survive. Sometimes it feels like I'm not surviving because of how intense the experience can be. You know, I have a lot of, I've been having a lot of, like, physical reactions to what's been going on. I find my body, like, when I'm doing work or when I'm talking about these things, my body is, like, going into shock a lot, and I'm having, like, a lot of, like, different problems in my body. So sometimes, am I actually surviving? But in terms of, like, what I'm doing for myself and what other people are doing and how I do my work and continue to sort of live through this, I think love is really the thing. I think we as women of color don't get enough love in society. Yeah. But it's really been powerful for me to get to work with some really awesome community organizers, both racialized people and allies, and to have that kind of, like, love from the community, and then really to sort of, like, root myself when I'm speaking, when I'm working in love, and think about, you know, who is it that I'm working for and why am I doing this, and think about that as my motivator.
Wow, that's really powerful. Thank you for sharing that. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your dreams for the future, about what kind of Quebec or what kind of world you hope to live in.
Yeah, it's hard. I was thinking about this one, and it's hard to have dreams right now as a Muslim woman and a person of color, a woman of color in Quebec. It's hard to imagine a Quebec that would really love women of color and love Muslims right now. But when I think about sort of what I can think of as dreams for Quebec, I'd really like to see, you know, I see this bill also as a massive attack on, like, social services, and like, there are lots of things that sort of indicate a lean towards privatization of things like healthcare and education. And so my dreams for Quebec are sort of like a renewed commitment to social welfare and some undoing of a lot of the damage that's been done in the past, like, 15 years, first under the Charest government and now under Pauline Marois, in terms of, like, dismantling social services and really gutting things like education and healthcare.
Right. So if people want to fight against this bill, what can they do? How can they get involved? What do you suggest?
I think right now one of the really important things is shoring up opposition, and that can happen by pressuring politicians who are in opposing parties. That can be done by, you know, if you're a part of a professional organization or if someone in your family is part of a professional organization, getting them to talk to their, like, representative organization about taking a stance against the charter. Doing other things like this, learning how to debunk racist arguments, and contributing to efforts to diffuse the ongoing climate of racism. I think those are really important ways that everyday people can interact with the situation.
Fantastic. Sara, thank you so much for being with us. We at Spitfire absolutely love and stand behind you and all the people both targeted by and fighting against this charter, and we look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thanks so much,
Malik.
Bye.
Bye. Turn me up. I want to hear the music.
Yeah.
I want to feel that vibe.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air? You didn't hear.
So in the last couple of minutes that we have here, I wanted to share with you guys a poem that I wrote for a fundraiser we had last night for a woman named Madame Awan, another Muslim woman targeted by the Quebec state. She's been denied refugee status, and she's taken sanctuary in a Montreal church to resist her deportation. So this one goes out to her. We came because they said it would be better, said it was all open opportunities and dreams fulfilled and children educated and cities where you were free to roam and to speak. We came here because home is hostile. You sent billions to men who did not represent us, who only sought to oppress us. And with your money, they bought mansions and machine guns, armies with artillery as far as the eye can see. You blamed us for the corrupt governments you yourselves installed and supported, winking at false elections and ignoring our protests as paranoid speculation. We left because we were afraid to speak in our homes. We left because they stole our businesses from us. We left because our children deserve better than scant education and no hope of work for those few that make it. We did not want to leave, but we had no choice. Not after you came in ships dressed for war, not after drones and slave traders and divide and conquer tactics and a neoliberalism that empowered our oppressors to shut down schools and defund the hospitals, not after your relentless all-white media campaigns coming and convincing us that even our own skin was shameful, that speaking our language was the mark of miseducation, that our men were brutal and our mothers ugly. And so we came, convinced of better across the ocean. You came to us, and so we thought it opportune to come to you. We came because they said it would be better, but now better has turned bitter as we discover that you don't want us. You ask about our educational background and our financial capacity, about the languages we speak and the politics we hold, all the questions we weren't able to ask you when you came to us. Why these questions, we wonder, but of course we already know. Now, as then, resource extraction is your business. See, you mined the land, ripped out the rivers, decapitated the mountains until nothing was left, nothing but us. Yes, us. After all, there's still blood running in these veins, sweat slick on face, there's still gold of some sort to be mined. Work, you scream, work, work until there is nothing left in you but to sit silently and watch on the television screen the lives of those who have leisure time. And for those of us who cannot work, cannot fill your factories and farms and feeding houses, you have no use for us. No patience, no papers, no patience, no papers. See, we came because we thought it would be better, but now bitter has turned bitter. But now better has turned bitter. But listen to me. You should have cut out my throat, torn apart my vocal cords, because as long as there is breath in this chest, I will fight. We will fight, and we will scream, and we will unite, and we will dream, and we will win.
Thank you so much, Malak. That brings us to the end of the show. We thank everyone who made the show possible. Spitfire Women of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. Write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca and check out spitfire.blogspot.com. Follow us on Twitter